Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Just a bit of a note, we are having some technical difficulties with SiriusXM Channel 141. We'll keep you posted on that. This is not the kind of health issue that most men want to talk about tonight, but it is just as important that they do talk about it, monitor it, follow it, and make sure they obey their doctor's orders when it comes to prostate health. September is Prostate Cancer Awareness Month, and tonight we're talking about it all, from the exam to cancer treatments and any and everything in between. My guests are Dr. Adam Metwalli, chief of the Urology Division at the Howard University Cancer Center in Clinton Burnside, senior outreach coordinator with the Howard University Cancer Center. Lines are open. Give us a call if you have a comment, if you have a question about your prostate health, if you have a question about prostate cancer, treatments, and the like. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You're certainly welcome to tweet me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Dr. Metwalli, thanks for joining me again.
Thanks for having me, Harold. I really appreciate the opportunity to reach out to your audience and answer any questions that they might have.
Absolutely. And Clinton, thank you so much for being on the program.
Yes, thank you as well for having me.
Absolutely. So, Clinton, I actually want to start with you tonight, because I think the most important thing outside of the clinical issue regarding prostate health is really the social implication of it. Why is it so difficult for men to talk about this?
Well, that's an excellent question. And honestly, I think it's a million-dollar question, because if we could figure that out, I think we would put a lot of urologists out of business. Not that I really want to do that. However, I do think it's extremely important for men to talk about it. But the problem is it's a little uneasy for men to talk about it, because it's a little embarrassing, because a lot of men, we're taught to be macho and brave and strong and all that we do. But then when it comes to prostate health, and prostate cancer being so serious, a lot of men, we shy from it. And with me being out in the community talking with a lot of men, they don't want to talk about it, because they say, well, if I talk about it, then that means that maybe I do have something and I'm less than. And a lot of men fear that. And so they try to avoid it as much as they can, when in actuality, if they talk about it, the better they are in terms of having the information they need to do something about it sooner rather than later.
You're saying that in some cases they may actually be even superstitious about bringing the topic up?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because oftentimes they hear a lot of horror stories about it. Instead of kind of getting the real facts, oftentimes we as men, we like to get in our own unique circles, and oftentimes we hear what we want to hear and not necessarily what's actually true about it. And oftentimes men, they get the piece, they hear what they really want to hear, and they run with that whether it's the full truth or not. But that's why it's important that we have to groups like this or opportunities like this to really talk to the community, to help them to better understand really what's going on and really how beneficial talking about not just prostate health, but their health in general, how easy things can be, because you realize that, this is difficult for me to go through it. But when I start talking about it, I realize that I'm not the only one going through it. So my friend's situation may not be exactly like mine, but maybe there's something that they went through that I can take from that to put me in a better position.
Dr. Metwalli, even before we get into the nuts and bolts of...
No pun intended.
I heard myself say that. Gosh, as soon as I said it, I was thinking, oh my gosh, I was going to let it slide. But, hey, a little bedside humor doesn't hurt. Is there any way for a man to tell that he may have a prostate issue before he has a conversation or an exam with his doctor.
Sure. You know, many of the symptoms associated with prostate disease are kind of obvious. And so if you notice a change, and sometimes these changes are gradual, they build up over years, but a change in your urination, you notice the stream is weaker, you've got more dribbling, it's, you know, you're getting it on your shoes or whatever instead of being able to write your name in the snow, or, you know, getting up more times at night to urinate, you know, that kind of thing, that might suggest that you've got something going on there. Now, as I said, those kind of symptoms are a little bit nonspecific because there are lots of reasons why those things can happen. They're not all necessarily prostate cancer, but if you notice symptoms like that, you probably should go get checked out.
Okay. So let's talk about the thing that nobody wants to talk about the prostate exam. Let's go ahead and as most men would say, go ahead, doc, let's just get it over with.
Absolutely. You know, and that's honestly the best way to do it. I'm a big believer in sort of just, you know, ripping the Band-Aid off as opposed to doing it one hair at a, excruciating hair at a time, you know. You know, to examine the prostate is really a pretty quick thing. And I think that in many cases, a man's anxiety over getting it done is actually worse than the exam itself for most patients. It really doesn't take very long. It does give us a fair amount of information. Now, you know, maybe 10 years from now or 15 years from now, we might be able to do away with it completely, either because of better, you know, blood testing or better imaging. But at this point, it is an important part of getting your prostate evaluated. There is a small but significant number of prostate cancers that are detected, you know, by the what we call the finger wave, as opposed to, you know, the blood testing or anything else. So, you know, it's definitely not something that anybody necessarily enjoys, but it's not also the end of the world. It's not really that big of a deal, and it doesn't, you know, take very long. It's pretty quick, and once you get it done, it shouldn't, you know, you shouldn't need to do it multiple times in a year. It's a once a year or maybe once every other year kind of thing, depending on your risk group.
Yeah, and, you know, we are talking about the digital rectal exam. What are you feeling for? What are you looking for with that exam? And how long does it take from beginning to end?
Yeah, so, well, that's a good question. And you know, I think the most important thing that people need to understand that they often don't get is that the prostate is not in the rectum. It's next to it. And so you're actually feeling through the rectal wall to feel the prostate. The prostate sits between the bladder and the urethra, and there's actually a layer of fat between the rectum and where the prostate is. And so when you put your finger in there, you're feeling basically the back half of the prostate. And what you're feeling for is that a prostate should be roughly about the size of a walnut, maybe a little bit bigger depending on your age. It should be smooth and symmetrical. You know, we as humans are symmetrical. You got two eyes and two arms and two lungs and all that. And the prostate kind of has two halves, and they should be roughly equal. And it should feel kind of like the end of your nose, sort of that kind of rubbery consistency if you were to put your finger on the end of your nose. So anything that you feel that's either asymmetrical, one side a lot bigger than the other, or if it's got a bump on it, like a, you know, pea-sized bump that's kind of hard, or if it's just a lot harder on one side than the other, that may suggest that there's something going on in there that requires further investigation. Now, how long does it take? I think it really depends. It depends on a bunch of things. Number one, it depends on how experienced your physician is. If you've done a lot of rectal exams, you can get a lot of information fairly quickly. I know when I was first learning, I spent more time doing it because I didn't know what I was feeling for. And I think that's somewhat true. But it's also the size of the prostate. Prostates can vary from, like I said, about the size of a walnut to as big as my fist. And I'm a pretty big guy. I wear size 8 gloves. And so the bigger your prostate, the more time it's going to take for me to kind of cover the whole size of it and get a sense of what's going on in there. And sometimes the prostates are too big to really feel the whole thing, and you just kind of do the best that you can. As far as how long it takes, In general, it takes less than a minute for me to do most prostate exams.
Mm-hmm. So here's another question, Clinton, and this is about the discomfort, piggybacking on that thing about the anxiety of the exam versus the exam. I know that for women, when they are having gynecological exams, your gynecologist is a man or a woman, but I know specifically if it's a man, you may have a nurse there to make sure that, for lack of a better term, everything is on the up and up. And this is really for both Clinton and for Dr. Metwalli. Do some men feel better if there's a nurse there, or if you have a spouse there, or does it vary patient to patient? Is that an unreasonable request just to help deal with any anxiety that they may be feeling?
Well, and that's a really good question. And I think it just kind of varies from among the individuals. I mean, I've had some men that have participated in our program that they want to be, by themselves. And, they even tell their spouses to go somewhere else while they have the exam. But then I also have some men that say, no, my wife made me come here, so I want her to be in here to hear everything that's going on. And, I was actually just at an event over this weekend, and I talked with a number of men, and what I came to realize is that for men, men tend to listen to what other men say, but we don't necessarily act on it until the women or the other people in our lives kind of push us to move forward with it. So it really just kind of varies. I think I think it's probably more men that are, more hesitant to go into a room with where there's females present for this type of exam. But I may be wrong. I mean, I think Dr. Metwalli, you have a lot more experience than myself in terms of what you're seeing in your clinic.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Clinton. Most men would prefer their partners leave the room when they're going to have the digital rectal exam done. I've actually had men who are uncomfortable with having a female urologist do the exam on them. I've also had a few that kind of would prefer it the other way because women's hands tend to be smaller. So, as you said, it's a bit of a mixed bag. But I agree with you, Clinton. I think it's really important to have, your better half in there with you during the discussions. They don't necessarily have to be in there for the digital rectal exam itself. But when we talk about, whether it's PSA results or biopsy results, like any significant person who's with you, I think is a good thing because it's a well-documented thing that when you get any kind of news, you're only catching a percentage of what's being said. And so two sets of ears in the room increases the likelihood that important information will be received and not missed. Mm-hmm. I always liken it to sort of drinking from a fire hose.
Yeah.
There's a lot of information that patients get, and because they're trying to keep track of it all, it's very common for them to miss important things. And so having another person in there who's listening, who's also not the patient, so they're not quite as anxious, increases the comprehension of the information that's being relayed.
God, and they say women are complicated. Men listen to men, but they don't act until the women tell them. Woo!
Yeah. That,
let me go to the phone lines quickly. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We're talking about prostate health and prostate cancer exams, treatment, and the like. John, calling from White Plains. Quickly, John, what's on your mind?
Yes, I just wanted to ask the doctor. I'm 51 years old, and just last week I was diagnosed with low rate prostate cancer. And the doctors gave me like two options because it was, very low, that, if I don't feel comfortable, I can do the surgery or radiation. So I just wanted to get some feedback from the doctors on how I should proceed with that.
I'm sorry. You sort of cut out there a little bit, so I missed. How old are you?
He's 51.
51.
And you said low-grade cancer. Is that what you said?
It's considered low-risk prostate cancer.
Yeah, so it kind of depends. Now, did they recommend treatment, or did they also give you the option of watching it?
Yeah, their recommendations from both doctors I talked to on last weekend, the surgeon I met with today, they recommend watching it.
Yeah.
But they were just saying if I didn't feel comfortable that I can either opt for surgery or do radiation.
Now, before you answer that question, and John, I need you to hang on because I've got to take a really quick break. Also, we want to let Diane from Brandywine know that we are also going to answer her question about her husband. So, Diane, I need you to hang on. Do not hang up. You will be able to hear. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Got that situation with SiriusXM fixed, so we will continue this conversation on SiriusXM. And certainly don't forget that you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Insights segment via podcast on WHUR.com. And don't forget you can download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone. And you can hear the program live in its entirety without interruption. If you're on the phone, stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on SiriusXM, Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. We'll be back to talk about this men's health issue on this Medical Monday. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. September is Prostate Cancer Awareness Month, and tonight we are talking about it all from the exam to cancer treatments and everything in between. My guests are Dr. Adam Itwali. He is chief of the Urology Division at the Howard University Cancer Center in Clinton Burnside, senior outreach coordinator with the Howard University Cancer Center. We have John on the line from White Plains. Doc, go ahead and answer John's question.
So, you know, it really depends what the on a number of things. You're relatively young at 51 to be diagnosed with prostate cancer. Prostate cancer takes an average of about 15, 16 years from diagnosis, treatment, recurrence to death. So if it's going to kill you, and most men die with their prostate cancer, not from it, you know, it's still going to, you know, you're talking about a 15-plus year sort of natural history. And so your overall health and your family kind of longevity all play a role in what the best decision to make is. You know, if you're really, really healthy 51-year-old and everybody in your family lives to be 90-something, you know, you may want to think about treating this at some point, although you don't necessarily have to do it right now. And that would probably be my recommendation, you know, because the treatments for prostate cancer definitely have a lot of side effects, whether it's radiation or surgery. And so if you're, you know, if you like your quality of life right now and you're not having any major issues in terms of urination and that kind of thing, then, you know, watching this thing for a little while is the only way you can guarantee that you're going to maintain your quality of life in terms of the way you urinate and your erections and that kind of stuff. Because all of the treatments for prostate cancer, other than active surveillance, will have an effect on the way you urinate and, you know, your erections. So now, on the other hand, if you're really, really unhealthy, and, you know, let's say everybody in your family dies in their early 60s, then, you know, treating your prostate cancer is kind of pointless, right? Because you're probably not going to live long enough for it to bother you. And so you have to take these factors into account when you make a decision about treatment. But in general, I would say, and I do this often with my patients, that, you know, let's watch it. You know, there's not, you know, at least we can give you 6 months, a year, maybe a year and a half or so, you know, with exactly the same quality of life that you have right now. And if it turns out that this cancer is a little bit more aggressive than we thought, we can go ahead and treat it, and we don't lose anything in terms of how good the outcome of the treatment is going to be. You know, and so generally speaking, that's kind of how we approach these things. But you also have to, you know, take stock of yourself, because if you're a really super anxious person and you can't really live with the idea that there's a cancer in there or that we're not doing something about it and it's going to drive you crazy, then you're probably not a great candidate for what we call active surveillance, where you just watch the, you know, watch it for the time being and see how it behaves.
Okay.
Yeah, because my father lived with it for 17 years, so, and he was diagnosed in his early 50s, so, you know, so he just passed away in 2019. After all was said and done. So, you know, I'm just trying to, you know, weigh my options and stuff like that. You know, with, you know, which way I should.
Did you say that he died of his prostate cancer?
Well, yeah, I think it was some other stuff, but he was diagnosed in his early 50s with it. But he lived 17 years, you know, from that. So he, like I said, he just passed away in 2019.
Well, you know, there's two ways to look at that. Number one is that you have a template there, because I mean, you can you've seen it in your own life what happens when you just watch the prostate cancer and kind of how that evolves. Right. But the other thing you need to keep in mind is that people with a family history, the second generation, sometimes the cancer is a little bit more aggressive than they were in the first generation. So the sons of men who had prostate cancer, who are then go on to be diagnosed with prostate cancer, tend to be diagnosed at an earlier age, but also sometimes will have a little bit more of an aggressive course. And so while I think that prostate cancer or active surveillance for your prostate cancer is a reasonable choice, the fact that you have a family history there means that I would watch you probably maybe a little bit more closely than, you know, some of my other patients who are on active surveillance.
Okay. John.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Good luck to you. Thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Diane. Calling from Brandywine. Thanks for hanging on, Diane. What's on your mind?
Recently, my husband went in for a physical, and he had a blood test. And I wondered if blood tests reveal anything, whether there's a prostate problem or not. But his doctor did recommend that he go have an exam, and he is very hesitant. I don't really think he's going to do it.
You mean a digital rectal exam? Or what kind of exam? MRI? What? Diane, can you hear me? Did we lose Diane? Dr. Metwali, did you hear that?
Only bits and pieces of it. It sounds like he had some blood work done, and they recommended that he see a urologist.
Yeah, she said an exam.
Right.
But she wasn't clear about what kind of. Okay, Diane, can you hear me? No. Can you hear me, Diane?
Yeah, I'm just in a bad location.
Oh, that's quite all right. You're down there in God's country in Brandywine.
Yeah.
Right. What kind of exam did they recommend?
They just said a prostate exam. But I really don't think he's going to do it, honestly.
Dr. Metwali, your thoughts about what Diane is sharing with us?
Well, I think that, that's probably not the best choice. Just because you go see a urologist doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get a rectal exam. But also, you know, as I said, the rectal exam itself is, you know, takes a minute, maybe a minute and a half. It's not really, a major issue, certainly not worth risking your, you know, future health and longevity to avoid. But, you know, we all make these kind of decisions. I think it might be worth at least making the appointment to meet with the urologist because, you know, without knowing what the level of the blood test is and what exactly which blood test was done, it's hard to know, you know, the urgency of this, situation. So, you know, if the PSA is only mildly, if it was a PSA and it's only mildly elevated, it may not be.
I think
that
they said
urgent.
It was a 4.
Yeah. So. You know, that's not really that high. And so, you know, I think that, you know, there's a possibility that he might get in there and, you know, not go down the road he thinks he's going down, you know, but he won't know unless he goes and talks to the urologist.
How old is your husband, Diane? Diane? Yeah.
Well, I'd actually like to add.
Sure,
add
go ahead.
That as well. And I think this could be applicable to John. The caller earlier is to connect with other men that are going through similar situations. I mean, I know there's a number of groups out there. I know we have one here at Howard University Cancer Center where it's a group of men. We get together once a month, and all we do is talk about men's health issues. Every month we talk about a different topic, but that would be an ideal place for men to come together with any questions that they have, because it's open, and we can talk about any and everything. But you can definitely get a different perspective. And there's a lot of men that came to our group, that come to our group, and they're a little hesitant. But when they get true and information that they can relate to, it kind of helps to ease some of their anxieties and realize, you know, this is really for my health. And if it's not for them, do it for your family members. So just really talking with someone that can help guide them through that, and not necessarily give them medical advice, but just kind of guide them through that process to let them know that they're not going through this alone. They're not the first one, and unfortunately, probably won't be the last.
Yeah, I agree with that, Clinton. My, you know, the guys that are in, you know, my orbit, you know, guys that I went to junior high school, with my fraternity brothers, and maybe that's the blessing, all of us, mm-hmm. we all have the same attitude towards these things. You know, nobody likes the thought of it, but, and let me say, I'm not talking about prostate exams or prostate health. I'm talking about, nobody wants to go to the doctor because there are better things to do. You know, I mean, you know, they, you know, they, it's not that we don't want to see the Dr. Met Wallies of the world, but who wants to go in and sit in the doctor's office and wait and be weighed and get jabbed, you know, and just go through any kind of, you know, have your doctor knocking on your chest and the, no, that's not fun. But the reality is that if you want to continue to have fun of any sort that has anything whatsoever to do with your health, whether you want to play basketball, whether or not you want to be able to continue to exercise, whether or not you want to continue to, you know, make love to your wife or your significant other, yeah, you know, go ahead and see your doctor. And it's, you know, it's really a short-term visit for a long-term solution. And I think that, you know, your buddies, your guys, they'll pop you in the back of your head, you know, when you, I don't want to do, yeah, okay, fine. I know you don't want to do it. Pop, go do it.
Yeah.
stop being silly. And, you know, that's kind of the way guys, you know, talk to each other. And they probably use other more colorful metaphors to get you to go, because they want you around, too. You know? Something to think about.
Absolutely. You know, I also share with men, you know, think about, you know, your what you've accomplished up to this point in your life. And think about the things that probably should have taken you out that didn't. So how can you look at something as, and I'm not minimizing prostate cancer, but how can you allow just the fear of going to the doctor, how do you allow that to take you out when you have survived all those other things in your life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes too much sense. Let's go to William. William calling from Brandywine. Calls coming from Brandywine. William, what's on your mind?
Clinic out in Brandywine.
Hey, good afternoon, Harold and the doctors.
How are you?
I guess a different situation. First of all, I'm like the rest of the guys that I didn't want to hear or listen to my body, but I end up listening to my wife, who tells me, hey, you must have this checked out. I did. I got the results back. She said, well, you want me to go with you? I said, nah, I got this. No big deal. Ends up being cancer. The doctors recommended, hey, watch it. Let's see how it goes. And I was like, I'm fine with that. But then I had a doctor's appointment with the radiation doctor, and he suggested, he's like, listen, you have a couple angry ones in there that I think it's best that we have surgery versus sit here and wait to see what happens 6 to 8 months down the road. I went and had the radiation surgery, which, you know, seemed to went well. The PSA dropped down originally from like 9 to 10 down to 1.25. It never dropped to zero. I went back to the doctor 6 months later. It rose back up to 4 to 5 again. Then they suggested to do another biopsy. So I'm going through my second biopsy which they did about, I guess, 18 samples. And then 6 months down the road, no, 3 months later or 2 months later, the quickest amount that they can do another biopsy, because my regular urologist, not saying the guy wasn't good, but I didn't believe him. So I went to John Hopkins on a recommendation, and the doctors up there were just incredible. So they did a third biopsy on me, where they took 32 samples because they thought it hit the external walls, I guess, to my bladder. And then my PSA rose again. So I don't want to go back to the doctors again, because I'm tired of biopsies. And then at this point, they can't do anything else without a complete, I was told, a salvage prostatectomy, which I'm not thinking I want to do.
Yeah, that's a tough situation. I mean, you really got a difficult situation there. I'm thinking that the biopsy that was done either by your home urologist or the Hopkins team demonstrated that there was still cancer in the prostate even after the radiation.
Did you hear that, William?
There's still cancer in the prostate even after the radiation.
Yes, well, they were going based on the PSA.
Did you hear that, William?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yeah, turn your radio down and just listen to the phone.
I did.
Okay. So go ahead.
Yes, they still couldn't determine why my PSA through the blood work. The tissue samples were not coming back as cancerous. And then I even went to this new, a new system where they put radiation in my body. And then they do the full body scan to see and determine if it went external of my prostate. So it ended up determining that there was nothing there, but they still couldn't figure out why it shows cancer, but it was not, in their eyes, from the samples they took, cancerous.
Wow. I mean, that's an even more challenging situation, because you had definitive treatment with radiation, which should have worked, and the PSA didn't do what it was supposed to do. And you've gone through two biopsies now, neither of which has shown cancer in the prostate that they've seen, but they still think it's there. You got a really, really tough problem. And I would say that, you know, doing a salvage prostatectomy, which is a prostatectomy after radiation, is a really, really difficult operation. There aren't many people who do them. And there are many places where they do them with any frequency. The outcomes tend to be not great. All the worst side effects of surgery are worse after you've had radiation. The healing situation is not great. So the complication rate is really, really high. A lot of urologists will opt for what's called cryoablation, where you freeze the prostate after radiation, because the surgery is just so difficult and has so many complications. But the thing that I find perplexing about that whole story is that, you know, if they have not been able to identify persistent cancer in the prostate, what is the point of removing it? It's one of these things where if the PSA is continuing to go up, they can't identify it in the prostate. It's probably somewhere else. They just haven't been able to find it yet. The limits of our ability to detect it is not, you know, these tests are not as sensitive as you want them to be. So if you got some cells in some other part of your body, whether it's the lymph nodes or the bones, and it's producing PSA and your PSA is at a level of 4 or, you know, higher now, it will show up eventually. You just have to kind of wait until the PSA gets a bit higher. And the fact that the radiology test was, you know, this whole body scan that you referred to was negative and didn't show cancer, doesn't mean that it's not there. It just means that whatever amount that was there is probably smaller than the limit of detection for that test. And if you wait a little bit, it will eventually show up. I would probably avoid doing a salvage prostatectomy because, you know, if this thing is going to come back, if this thing is going to turn out to be, you know, what we call metastatic, meaning having spread outside the prostate, which it sounds kind of like maybe it is, you know, going through a salvage prostatectomy is going to dramatically change your quality of life. What I would say is that I wouldn't stop going to the doctor. I just would talk to them, you know, and not feel pressured to undergo the surgery unless, you know, there's some reasonable degree of certainty that they're actually going to be able to fix the problem with that, just because that's a very, very complicated surgery with a lot of complications.
William, thank you so much for sharing your story with us, and we certainly, you know, wish you all the best and continued health. Let's talk a little bit about, first of all, we've kind of thrown some things around in answering some of the questions, and so let's get a little bit of this prostate health 101. Let's talk about what is PSA and what would be considered a normal number versus an abnormal number, Dr. McWally.
Yeah, so PSA stands for prostate-specific antigen, and that's actually not really an appropriately named test because it's not specific to the prostate. And it's certainly not specific to prostate cancer, but it's a screening test that we use to detect prostate cancer. And essentially, the higher it is, the more likely you have a prostate cancer. But you can have a high PSA and not have prostate cancer. And you can also have a low PSA and have prostate cancer. So, but the percentage of men who have a clinically relevant prostate cancer increases as the PSA goes up. As far as what is a normal number or a threshold, it really depends on your age. The older you are, the higher we're willing to accept the PSA going to be, and the younger you are, the lower it should be. And so when PSA first came out in the late 80s and early 90s, the kind of cutoff that we used was 4. And then as we got more sophisticated with it, we kind of dropped it down to 2.5. And then as we understood more about the natural history of prostate cancer, we sort of bumped it back up again to around 4. But again, it really depends on your age. If you're 38 and you have a PSA of 4, you've got a real problem. If you're 88 and you have a PSA of 4, you're fine, and we're going to leave you alone. So there's a little bit of nuance associated with how we deal with this test. And I often tell my patients that it's not really the absolute threshold that matters. It's kind of the trend line. Because if it's 2 and then the next year it's 2.5 and then the next year it's 3.5 and then the next year it's 4, that's a problem. Whereas if it's 4 and then the next year it's 4 and then the next year it's 4, that's not really as much of a problem. So it's not just the absolute number, but it's also kind of the direction that it's going, and which is why it's important to follow up with your urologist and create that relationship and, you know, have, you know, discussions about what it means and what you're seeing in the numbers. And prostate cancer is not the only reason why PSA can go up. You can have an enlarged prostate, and that can cause it to go up. You can have an infection in your prostate, and that can cause it to go up. And interestingly enough, if you had sex within 24 hours of getting your test drawn, that can actually cause your PSA to go up. And so can a, you know, vigorous digital rectal exam. So if somebody like me goes in there and really, you know, gets in there to take a deep feel, that can actually cause your PSA to go up a little bit as well. And so there's a number of contextual things that you have to take into account when you look at the number.
Can you talk to us about some of the more common treatments once someone is diagnosed with some of the first stages of prostate cancer that are, you know, that will allow them to have a good quality of life?
Well, the treatments really kind of depend on the grade of the prostate cancer. And as our listeners have probably heard earlier, if you have a low volume, meaning not very much cancer in the prostate, low grade prostate cancer, the treatment of choice is active surveillance. It's, you know, when I was first training, you know, we either operated on everybody or radiated everybody, and that's because we didn't know how long it actually takes for a prostate cancer to progress and kill a man. And, you know, what we've learned, because it takes so long for the prostate cancer to grow, that if you don't have a 10-year life expectancy, it's probably not worth treating your prostate cancer at all, unless it's really, really aggressive. So for low-risk prostate cancers, we often will just watch them. For intermediate-risk prostate cancer, prostate cancer comes in a variety of grades, 3, 4, and 5, and you know, if it's 3 plus 3, so you look at the cancer and it's all kind of grade 3, that's considered a low-grade prostate cancer, and we will often watch those, particularly if there's not a lot of it in there. Once you get any pattern 4 in there, that's considered intermediate risk, and we generally recommend treatment. Certainly pattern 5 is high risk, and that increases dramatically your risk of having disease that's going to spread. So of the treatments, once we get into the intermediate risk disease, the standard treatments are surgery to remove the prostate. It's called radical prostatectomy, and that's typically done through minimally invasive incisions using a surgical robot. And radiation. And radiation can be delivered from the outside of the body, that's called external beam radiation, or from inside the body where they actually insert radioactive seeds into the prostate and kind of cook it from the inside out. And when you look at, you know, impact on quality of life and cure rates and that kind of stuff, the cure rates are essentially the same whether you choose surgery or radiation, but you have kind of a different set of choices when you talk about side effects. And, you know, the side effect profiles for the treatments can negatively affect your ability to urinate. It's not uncommon for men who have surgery to have some degree of incontinence where they're leaking urine. Now, most men will be able to recover their ability to control their urine, but you sort of have to relearn how to do that because the prostate is intimately involved in your ability to keep your urine in your bladder and not on your pants. And so there's a little bit of retraining that goes on in the first couple of months after surgery, after which about 95% of men should be able to control their urine pretty successfully. With radiation, if you get external beam radiation, the radiation doesn't just hit the prostate, but also hits the bladder and the rectum. And so it's very common to have frequency and urgency, sometimes incontinence, not only of the urine, but also the stool sometimes. And that's usually temporary. As long as you're getting treated, these symptoms will occur, and then they generally get better over time. But radiation causes DNA damage, which is what kills the prostate cancer, but it can also affect your ability to heal and can result in some other problems along the way. Mm-hmm. And then the nerves that control your erection sit on either side of the prostate. So if you have a surgery and you save those nerves, you have a pretty good chance of maintaining usable erections. You may need Viagra if you weren't using it before. If you have bad erections going into any treatment for prostate cancer, you can guarantee they're going to get a lot worse after any treatment. Mm. If you have good erections, you know your ability to maintain a usable erection is pretty good after surgery. And what you see is that the impact on your erections after surgery is immediate, and then it gets better over time. Whereas with radiation, it's the opposite. Your erections basically are the same after radiation treatment as they were before, but then they get progressively worse over a couple of years. And so at about 2 years, you're more or less in the same place in terms of your ability to achieve and maintain erections. Mm-hmm. And so those are kind of the side effects. But we typically will say that, you know, the goal is to cure the prostate cancer. That's number one. Number two is to maintain your continence, your ability to control your urine, because that's a quality of life issue. Nobody wants to be 50 or 60 years old and in a diaper.
Yeah.
And then erections are third kind of on the list, because if you have difficulty with erections after treatment with prostate cancer, we have a lot of options in order to maintain that part of your life. It's not just Viagra, Levitra, and Cialis. There's injections, there's vacuum erection devices, there's implantable penile prostheses. So we can give you those back one way or another after treatment. And so the main thing is to make sure that we treat the prostate cancer successfully and then, make sure that you're not wearing a diaper, hopefully.
Before we leave, Clinton, talk to me in these last couple of minutes about Men Take 10, the program at HU's Cancer Center.
So, yeah, the Men Take 10 program at Howard, it's about 20, 25 years old, and it's actually an early detection and education program in which we go out into the community to different health fairs, faith-based organizations to give presentations, and we even do one-on-one talks as well. And I mentioned earlier the group that we have, and in which it's just a group where we want to give men education, all the education they can get or that they want on their prostate health, but not just prostate health, but their health overall. Because oftentimes we find that a lot of situations with prostate cancer are exacerbated because of other health issues. So we want men to focus on their overall health. So that's where the Men Take 10 program comes in, to help give you that education. And we also have a component that we're where we go out into the community and offer prostate cancer screenings as well. And then once you get screened, we send you a copy of your results, as well as recommendations from one of our urologists as to whether or not your results are considered normal or if they recommend you do any other type of follow-up. But again, I think the key is really having the conversation with your doctor or your family member or a healthcare professional that can help guide you through the process. And what, that's exactly what the Men Take 10 program does.
Where can I find out information about that online for our listeners?
So right now you can go to it's cancer.howard.edu.
Okay.
Yes.
Cancer.howard.edu. I'll make sure that I look that up and put it on our website along with this conversation for the Daily Drum tonight. Gentlemen, I want to thank both of you for spending some time with us and making sure that we get the fellas on the straight and narrow, even if we have to tell their wives to get them there.
Absolutely.
Thanks for giving us the opportunity to join you and your audience.
Sure thing. Dr. Adam Mitwalli and Clinton Burnside, again, thank you so
much.
Thank you very much. That is the Daily Drum for this Monday, September 20th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.